Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And folks, it is now or never. And what we want to do is we want to kind of quickly invite and welcome back Mr. Venable, Paul Venable, thank you so much. It means so much to me to have the assistance and actually to have somebody else read it, because I know as I've read it for the past so many years, you know, it seems like it may be just boring for me to do it all the time. But hopefully you don't mind, and hopefully you're actually gaining something out of actually doing this.
I am, and I think the cool thing is that as I can read it, you can kind of prep comments. You know, you're not right in the thick of reading it, and you can prep comments as you can see an important point coming forward. And, you know, and because I always have questions, by the way, and so it's really good of you to be able to answer my questions, because I try to not just, I don't just have questions for myself, but sometimes there's a point that your listeners may need to understand as well.
Yeah. So here's an interesting thing. That what you just covered is what I would say is the key selling points, the strengths that they saw in this Constitution. And actually what you covered yesterday, one of those key strengths was the oath itself. Mm-hmm. That we would have the ability to hold them accountable, that they would be held and we could remove them because of their oaths. That was a key selling point. And so you're halfway through. And so where we are, folks, is we're still on, I mean, maybe kind of expand my view on this. But as I look at this, we are still on January 23rd, which is the Wednesday. So, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, actually last week, Tuesday, Wednesday, and now today, we're still covering comments on the 23rd. So in other words, some really strong arguments and comments started coming out as they were trying to, you know, feel out this Constitution and kind of, you know, stretch it out and take, you know, examine it in the earlier days of this convention. We're right here in the heat of it. We're right in the middle of the convention, so to speak. And we're now, you know, really getting some very strong arguments, and they're highlighting, you know, hey, we kind of covered these oaths. This is big. And so where you kind of left off, and you go ahead and start all over again on the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union with Mr. Bowdoin's comments. And there's a couple paragraphs here. And then we'll jump down to his final comment where he gets into delegated again, because the whole point is, he's actually starting to point out what they have the authority to do. And, you know, he wanted to play out this oath thing. So if they do things that they don't have the delegated power to do, you can actually use the oath against them and get rid of them. But somehow we've been co-opted to believe that, you know, hey, these guys are supposed to solve our problems and work together and come to a conclusion. No. They can't solve problems by agreeing to violate the Constitution.
I'll tell you what else we've been co-opted to believe, GR.
Yeah.
That we have to wait till the next election to fix these problems.
Yes, that's true. Good point. Okay. Good point. That right. We can actually start fixing these problems today, start holding them accountable today, which is exactly what we're trying to do in, you know, like South Dakota, in Wyoming, and so forth. What we want to do is we want to bring the heat on all of these, you know, these legislators, county commissioners, and so forth, because that way we can affect the election tomorrow. Start holding them accountable today, because if you wait and you do it in a campaign that's only a couple months long, you stand no chance to get the people educated and stirred up. It takes a long time to stir up the people's, you know, anger, disprove, to say, hey, this guy is violating his oath and this is how bad it is, and they're doing nothing. These people don't deserve to be in office. It takes a while to create that argument. This is why doing it now before the 2024 even comes along, using 2023 as a part of your campaign. Right. So that's why I'm hoping that you're holding Josh Hawley accountable. If you're going to run up against him in 2024, you need to start calling him out now for, you know, his failures to actually mention that the militia should be down on that border when he was talking in this investigation last week in the Senate on this, you know, this invasion on our southern border that he was classifying as an immigration crisis.
You know, in my campaign stops, I was calling out all of the Republicans. Should I decide, you know, to do this run, calling out Josh Hawley is going to be very interesting indeed.
Right, but
because they all say, you know, it's, I think what bothered me just a few months ago, Ted Cruz is down on the border, just lamenting about how children are treated. I said, hey, Ted, how about the Constitution? How about Congress shall have power to call for the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, Ted?
Those kids wouldn't even be there if we were upholding the law. But instead, the State Department is sending these signals, hey, come on, get across the line, you're homebound.
Let me tell you something else I've heard, and I've had it acknowledged, but I haven't backed it up yet. I'll share this anyway. That now they're flying them to Canada, and they're coming down this from the northern border.
I believe
that a pain.
I believe that. But it's now the time of year where they can get away with it. But, you know, I don't know if you know this, but it just snowed this weekend in Wyoming and in Montana and so forth. So if they've got people in the mountains coming across the open border on our north, these people are dying because they're not properly equipped, they're not properly addressed, and so forth. You know what I mean?
Well, the Western United States is probably a hazardous place to do that. I don't think it's snowing, you know, on the border here or to the east, but it is colder, quite a bit colder.
Right.
So that'd be interesting.
But if you go to Michigan and east all the way over to the coastline, there's a lot to just run the border. You've got the the St. Lawrence River, right? And all of these bodies of water. So the only place that really where you can, you know, get on the land and start running your little 2 feet happy into America would be really from Illinois all the way over to Washington.
Right.
Where, you know, you got all this open space.
Illinois is not. You got Michigan, Wisconsin. Well, you know, Minnesota and North Dakota are not very nice, you know, until maybe June or July.
Well, Michigan's the same way.
Right.
Right. I mean, Michigan, Wisconsin, that whole area, it's either water or inhabitable because you're just, And so I can see that it would be feasible to start flying them to the north. I mean, if you really want to just attack America with as many people as possible, and the people that I'd be shipping through the, you know, across the Canadian border would be the Chinese, the Islamists, and, you know, these other evil players that are coming here knowing what they're supposed to do, because a lot of these people are just coming here with their hands out. They're trying to overwhelm our welfare system. But, you know, on the northern border, it would just, because these people are coming from outside of the, you know, outside of the Americas anyway. Why go to Mexico when boom, you just go up there?
Well, imagine one other thing, and then I'll back out of this rat hole.
Sure.
Is that look at what Canada has become. Because our largest trading partner with whom we have the longest border is now a socialist / communist leading nation. The people are lamenting and the government is just completely out of control. I can actually imagine the Canadian government supporting invasion from the north.
Sure.
I don't like to think about it. I don't like to say it. But I can actually imagine your government doing that.
Yeah, they're shills for the Chinese Communist Party. Yes.
Sure.
Yes.
So, anyway, I'm ready to get back to Okay. Let me read this. I want to reread this.
It's easy to get the... Oh, go ahead. Reread whatever you wanted to start off with.
Right. This go is ahead. Appropriate.
Okay.
Quote, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion and domestic violence, end quote. Okay. How right. irrelevant.
Yep.
So now I'll go down to the rest of it. To these great checks may be added several other very essential ones, as the negative which each house has upon the acts of the other, the disapproving power of the president, which subjects those acts to a revision by the two houses, and to a final negative, unless two-thirds of each house shall agree to pass the returned acts. Notwithstanding the president's objections, the printing the journals of each house containing their joint and respective proceedings, and the publishing from time to time a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money, none of which shall be drawn from the treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law.
In other words, made by law means that it would be in pursuance to the Constitution.
Correct.
Right. Okay. So here's the one thing that kind of jumped into my head really quick. So the president has the ability to veto a bill. Now, one of the things that these guys didn't mention, that nobody mentioned, because what if Congress actually created a bill that would absolutely be a direct violation of the Constitution? Well, the president has the power not to enforce that. And even though they can override his veto, he can now, with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, go after every person who voted for such bill that violated the Constitution. So in other words, he may not have the ability to disassemble and dismantle all of the government that's being created. That has to be done by the states. But the president mm-hmm. does have the ability to actually execute Section 3 of the 14th Amendment by removing people for violating the oath of office. And wow. basically tell the America this is going to be on the presidential page that this is one thing that could actually be it. And the best way to do this is, I think the people need to start getting smart, whether you use common law grand juries. We got to become literate on the Constitution, because you know that they're going to try to say, oh, well, this is constitutional because we said so. No. No, it has to be based on, this is why it is so important. And it saddens me that, there's not one party out there that is calling for definitizing the Constitution, when I'm trying to unite people to say, if we don't definitize it, they're going to keep making it up as they go along.
Right.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I get all
that's fine.
Going. Forgive me. Thank you.
All of these checks and precautions provided in the Constitution must, in a great measure, prevent an abuse of power, at least in all flagrant instances, even if Congress should consist wholly of men who were guided by no other principle than their own interest. Under the influence of such checks, this would compel them to a conduct which, in the general, would answer the intention of the Constitution. But the presumption is, and if the people duly attend to the objects of their choice, it would be realized that the President of the United States and the members of Congress would, for the most part, by men not only of ability. Just a minute, GR, I had something happen.
Uh-huh.
Hold on.
Not only of ability.
Yeah, where is it?
I've got it. If you got something in your eye, I can finish reading or whatever.
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Because okay.
something just...
Okay, so I'll finish reading and I'll pick way. It up. At the President of the United States and the members of Congress would, for the most part, be men not only of ability, but of a good moral character, in which case an abuse of power is not to be apprehended, nor any error in the government, but such as every human institution is subject to. So in other words, they would basically do the honorable thing and not violate the Constitution. Again, they couldn't fathom such a corrupt species. you know, that would be living and occupying the American states that we have today. They didn't fathom this, but they recognized that this had all the checks by the oaths of office and everything else. The one thing, as I tell you, the one thing that it missed was Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So are you okay, Paul?
Yeah, I'm okay. I had to mute, but I'm back now. Okay. Yes, that they didn't have that at the time. They do now, but they didn't have it at the time. So yeah,
right.
But they did have the oath.
Yes, yes, they had the oath, and they had the moral character to use the oath. But see, the problem was that the society's morals slowly eroded along with the baking in of corruption. In other words, the things that they thought made them safe actually allowed things to degenerate and to a point that took us to the Civil War, such as, you know, we're familiar with how the 1808 ending of the slave trade actually ended the ability for slavery to expand in America and actually got it to a point where it was actually decreasing. And so this created a lot of anxiety in America, especially after the War of 1812 and after America finally came to peace, or I shouldn't say peace with Britain, but Britain finally had to start honoring its treaties. And so Britain has always been the evil player trying to actually take us down. And that's what, and they successfully did through the corruption, not successfully legitimately, but successfully have under, there are undermining us, successfully gotten this far in undermining us, but we still have all the power and authority to actually vanquish them, to just whoosh, blow them away. But my point is that this was an evolutionary process that, you know, the perversions and I should say the self-interest, like he was talking about, that these men, even if they had self-interest, would still be of a moral character, that they wouldn't be consumed by that. But these men, I didn't think could fathom, you know, how it would all kind of start snowballing as moral character started going down as the states. Because the other thing is, every state in the Union actually had its own state-sponsored religion. One of the things that they didn't see changing was that the states would stop, you know, having the symbiotic relationship where the churches were taking care of the temporal welfare, taking care of the, you know, the education, healthcare, the, you know, welfare, job, and all that type of stuff that the church was doing, the state didn't have to do. So when the state actually stopped paying the church to do that, that's when the people go, well, if you're not giving them the money to do that, which we like, then you need to do it. And that is when the dread came in, because they should never have done that. They never had the authority to do that. They would
do what?
To actually provide welfare. When I look at the state constitutions, when I look at the Wyoming and South Dakota constitutions, the people have never delegated the authority to the state of South Dakota, Wyoming. I'll bet you anything in Missouri, they did not do the same thing with regarding to health care or regarding the seizure of controlling the children and taking away parental rights. Those things are not delegated. They have become federally mandated, and the states are just bowing to this unconstitutional federal government.
So that leads me to a question. This general idea leads me to a question, and that is, they trusted back then that they would have people of a decent moral character. They were self-governing.
Yep.
How important do you think that is now? I mean, we've got an uphill battle because the corruption is so deep, so intense, and so incestuous that you know, the question is, how do we break through?
The law.
Now.
The law.
Okay.
Because the law, the Constitution, and the 14th Amendment holds it down. In other words, you don't have to have a moral person anymore, because if we are a Republican form of government where the law is king, you violate the law, you fail to support your oath, you fail to support the Constitution, then you're gone. You to do anything, if we live by the law and we enforce the law, that's all we have to do. We don't have to teach people, you know, about mores and saving their, you know, getting them into church for their salvation. But God gave us the necessary law to keep the ship on course.
That's an important point.
Because if we
follow
the law. If we get the ship on course, it opens the doors of the churches, because what happens when all of a sudden the people do not have the ability to get a handout from government? Where do they go? And if they restore the framework that they had, where the state actually starts working again with the churches, then the churches, who are really self-ran by their parishioners, where the majority, because the state was only paying a stipend. They weren't the key funders of the church. The church was surviving off of the tithes and offerings of the people, and the state was only giving them a little bit of their operational assistance, and possibly, you know, in ways like, you know, the church shouldn't need infrastructure. I mean, the internet and those types of things, the government could give them to them, but they didn't give them everything. And so this is why I get into how to bring back a welfare system by empowering the churches to do it and giving the state the ability to assist a little bit based on the need. So in other words, if a church has parishioners where, you know, if you, let's say you have 100,000, you know, you got this church, let's call them the red church and the blue church. And the red church has, you know, supposedly 100,000 members. And out of the 100,000 members, all of them are close to 100% tithe payers. In other words, they pay their 10%. In other words, all of them pay their full amount. Now, the blue church over here, nobody pays anything. They're godless, but it's still a godless church where they teach evolution and those types of things, and everybody's out for themselves, and they're not willing to give to a church to do that, but a few people, so that this church is kind of struggling. Well, then why would the state help that church? Because you have to be vested into it. So this is why you look at that church as being more of a parasite than a church that is actually taking care of the temporal welfare, and that the people are willing to be contributors in helping each other. Because if you're helping each other, then that's a good thing for society. But a blue church would be not a help. It would be parasitical. Like if, let's say, Soros was funding the blue church and that's how they were getting their money, then that's not a parishioner-supported church. So they would get no money.
So here's another.
But does that make sense? Does that make sense of how the state would be able to provide a limited assistance? They would not be fully funding. But there could become a point in time where there may be necessary, like food and so forth. The state can actually, because if the state goes down the path like they should and actually have a food reserve for their peoples in case of emergencies, then they can actually use the church system, you know, by giving the food and so forth to those churches that, you know, are parishioner support.
Okay.
What this does is it forces the godless people to actually put their money where their mouth is. You want support? Then you actually have to actually take a part of your pay and give it to this godless church. And that's something that's really hard for those people to do. Were you laughing?
Right.
You were laughing, weren't you?
Yes, I was. It's interesting.
Because it's holding their feet to the fire. Because they're hypocrites.
Part of the challenge is it's not, and it's, again, a development mindset. We're so used to the ideas that the government shouldn't be giving money to the church, but how shouldn't be injecting.
So, Paul, hold your thought. Let's get right back to what you were saying when we come back from break, because believe it or not, we already hit a break. So we will be right back after this short promo, and then we can come right back to where you were talking about in the church and so forth. Forgive me, we have a hard break. Thank you so much, folks. We'll be right back after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So, okay, when we bring Paul back in now, and I forgive me for having these hard breaks, but that's the only way I can do it. So bottom line, when we look at what I was just talking about, the way the churches were set up is they had a monopoly. In other words, the Anglican Church or the Puritan Church or the Baptist Church, they were the only church and they didn't allow any other Christian church. So when the churches started to step away from this dominant church, arresting people and so forth, like what was going on, they should have moved to where they said, you know, if you are a church that is using natural or the laws of nature, nature's God, in enlightening people and making society better, then we will support all churches. We'll take this little stipend that we were giving this one church and we're going to divide it up equally based on your parishioner strength and contributions. In other words, based on how, you know, the stronger the church is, let's say, you know, 100% of the people are full tithe payers and, you know, contributors and so forth, then they would actually get the maximum stipend that they could possibly get. The other churches that may not be so much, like the God, you know, the godless church that nobody's contributing, that they're, you know, basically, you know, the only reason this godless church exists is because Soros money, then they wouldn't get anything. And this really forces everybody to understand that there is a symbiotic relationship between people in society contributing to help everybody become self-sustaining, to be able to make sure everybody becomes full contributors to society. The godless church, you know, wants to make you become a shill, and they actually want to use you for their own purposes, to, you know, cause Bolshevik revolutions and so forth. This is how, you know, people, indigent people, are utilized as shills, because all of these revolutions always come from the poor.
We should have a further discussion on this. I think what will happen is that as the states definitize the Constitution, and as they begin to be more free and more Republican, that I actually kind of see that the people may be less burdened by taxes. Americans can be a generous people.
We're very generous, yes.
And unless, of course, they find themselves in a position where they're barely surviving, and then they've got to pull in.
Right.
All right. But if we can enhance their liberty, then I can see them being generous again. I wonder if the ship has sailed in terms of the idea of giving money to churches. I mean, but what I can see, let's say if the state has a food reserve, that food reserve can be made available to churches who have a need to help their parishioners.
Okay, so think about it this way. When there are necessary services that help society, you know, move up the enlightened, you know, ladder, education is one of those things. And so do we want the government to do that, or would we rather allow the religions to do that for their people? And so I'm the advocate to say, you know, let's prove who's better. Let's prove who actually are the winners, because I'm going to tell you, the godless church is not going to have the, you know, this high position on the ladder, because they're going to be ill-educated, and it'll be a caste system where you have, you know, just the elitists that are, you know, paying for the church and using all of these people as their minions, where in a true Christian churches, everybody's pulling everybody up the ladder. Even Christ said that you will always have the widow, you will always have the lame. You know, so you'll always have these people, but there's no reason why a person who can carry their own weight, I see it all the time where a man is standing up and saying, I'm disabled, and he can clearly get a job and cover, you know, carry his own weight. The guy walked into that room. I don't know what his disability is, but he uses that as an excuse because the system will reward you if you bow to it. And that is an evil, destructive system, where Christianity would say you should do what you can.
Right.
And if we have that paradigm, then everybody has, even the widow herself would say, I should be contributing if she can. I mean, any self-respecting person would say, I can't just take this. I have to contribute somehow.
Sure, and that's kind of what I'm depending on. That's right. Kind of what I have in mind.
Right, okay, good. There you go.
Okay, all right, so we are strayed a little bit. I think it's important, these issues, but...
Well, these issues come up because this is the heart and mind of these men, because they're righteous men. Mm-hmm. So they're going to bring up these righteous perspectives, and so you can't help that. Right? I mean, we have to talk about that, and we can't gloss over this with secular godlessness to say, oh, correct. Well, see how evil these people were? Because they were God-fearing people. That's terrible. That's what made America great. What's destroying America is what these godless people have gotten away with.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay. So we're still with Mr. Bowden.
Yes, we are.
And I think he's gotten to, now he's speaking of that which is delegated. So we're going
to
go.
He's getting back to the delegated again, right?
Okay. With regard to rights, the whole Constitution is a declaration of rights which primarily and principally respect the general government intended to be formed by it. The right of particular states or private citizens not being the object or subject of the Constitution, they are only incidentally mentioned. In regard to the former, it would require a volume to describe them, as they extend to every subject of legislation not included in the powers vested in Congress. And in regard to the latter, as all governments are founded on the relinquishment of personal rights in a certain degree, there was a clear impropriety in being very particular about them. By such a particularity, the government might be embarrassed and prevented from doing what the private as well as the public and general good of the citizens and states might require. The public good in which private is necessarily involved might be hurt by too particular an enumeration, and the private good could suffer no injury from a deficient enumeration, because Congress could not injure the rights of private citizens without injuring their own, as they must, in their public as well as private character, participate equally with others in the consequence of their own acts. They've been avoiding that.
So what he's pointing out is whatever law they pass, it must be inflicted upon them. They cannot immune themselves. Keep going.
Okay. and by this most important circumstance in connection with the checks above mentioned to several states at large, and each citizen in particular will be secured as far as human wisdom can secure them against the abuse of the delegated power.
There you go. Okay, so if you really think about it, you know, living by the law and understanding the law, we would have avoided so many problems. But it's when a few people get in there and they go, you know what, we might be able to carve out something. And it started with lawyers. We're going to create our own, you know, accreditation registry so that only we can practice. You know, the union, the first existence of the union, do you know when it was?
I don't.
It goes all the way back to, I think the guy's name was Hippocrates or whatever, the guy that created the Hippocratic Oath.
Okay.
And if you read the Hippocratic Oath means that you will only share your knowledge with those who already have it or those of your family. In okay. other words, you know, the skills that you learn and develop, you're not to share with those people, but you're to take care of those people. Read the Hippocratic Oath. It will reek of union collectivism, you know, of elitism and so forth. The bar association is identical. In other words, okay. this is for us. And those who make it into, you know, this realm, and we don't want anybody practicing medicine or law that aren't accredited by us, which is why you have to be accredited in America for the medical association.
Correct.
And so I take it you're looking up the Hippocratic Oath. And so,
I actually am looking it up. I have. I think this is the ancient oath, but but correct.
Hippocrates or whatever his name was, right? And so, if when right. you in reading it, it basically says that you know, not all people should be doctors. Only those of us who have the skill and our families are to keep this skill amongst us and not to share it. You want to read it instead of having the dead air? Have you found
sure.
it?
Sure. Okay.
Go ahead, read it.
Sorry, I'm looking at it. So this is, I found this on Wikipedia. So, you know, I'm giving the source. And here is what it says is the earliest surviving copy. Okay. It has it in Greek and then it translates it into English. So I'm not going to read the Greek for you. I'll read it in English.
Thank you.
I swear by Apollo, healer, by Asclepius, by Hygienia and Panacea, and by all the gods and goddesses, making them my witness, that I will carry out, according to my ability and judgment, this oath and this indenture, to hold my teacher in this art equal to my own parents, to make him partner in my livelihood when he is in need of money to share mine with him, to consider his family as my own brothers, and to teach them this art if they want to learn it without fee or indenture, to impart precept, oral instruction, and all other instruction to my own sons, the sons of my teacher, and to indentured pupils who have taken the healer's oath, but to nobody else. I will use those dietary regimens which will benefit my patients according to my greatest ability and judgment, and I will do no harm or injustice to them. Neither will I administer a poison to anybody when asked to do so, nor will I suggest such a course. Similarly, I will not give to a woman a pessary to cause abortion, but I will keep pure and holy both my life and my art. I will not use the knife, not even verily on sufferers from stone, but I will give place to such as are craftsmen therein. Yep. Into whatsoever houses I enter, I will enter to help the sick, and I will abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm, especially from abusing the bodies of man or woman, bond or free. And whatsoever I shall see or hear in the course of my profession, as well as outside of my profession in my intercourse with men, if it be what should not be published abroad, I will never divulge, holding such things to be holy secrets. Now, if I carry out this oath and break it not, may I gain forever reputation among all men for my life and for my art. But if I break it and forswear myself, may the opposite befall me. That's the oath.
Okay, so in other words, if you really read it, then who's supposed to get the knowledge of what you're doing? It is only those who take the oath, in other words, enter into this world of doctory, or, you know, becoming a doctor, and not to share it with anybody. Only those people who are under an oath, such as, you know, and the teacher and your family. So in other words, your family kind of isn't under the umbrella of your oath.
Correct.
Interesting, huh?
And and in fact, what's interesting is it's the person who's giving you the oath is you might be obliged to teach his sons, and they specify sons.
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And so it is a it is
a select
along
right
from it's father a... to son and from giver to taker of the oath, and not outside of this group.
Right. So in other words, and as a matter of fact, they as they advance, they also advance in controlling. So in other words, you could come along and say, I want to become a doctor. And they say, well, we're only allowing so many, because that's what the AMA does. They only allow so many doctors to come into this. And you have, then they have all these standards. And in some ways, it's, you know, you see some good to it, but it's clearly a club, just like the Bar Association.
Correct.
These are elite societies where if you follow the oath, you're not supposed to cause any harm, and you're obligated to it. In other words, I don't know if there's an obligation to serve without pay, but bottom line is, I don't think you have the option, if somebody is dying, that you need to do what you can to save them. But, you know, if they can't pay you, then what do you do? I don't know if it covers some of those types of things, but it creates those that, you know, it's the same thing with the lawyers. But the lawyers, see, so what was the date of the Hippocratic Oath?
Let me see if I can find it here. AD 275 is when the oldest partial fragments of the oath were
But when did Hippocrates or whatever his name was, when did he live and die?
460 to 370 BC.
There you go. So in other words, this oath that they had been operating for 600 years. And that the first, you know, document that they have of that oath that they maintain today kind of came from there. And see, my whole point, folks, is that this has been a long time running. It's longer than the law professions. The only other professions that, you know, have actually superseded this is the farming. You know, the farming is the oldest profession. It goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. Some people say prostitution was, but I don't believe that there was a prostitute before there was a farmer.
I think they've called the prostitution the second oldest profession.
Oh, okay. That's what I heard. Oh, okay. Maybe so. But when you look at it, you've got husbandry, and then you have ranching, because depending. See, Cain was what? Cain was a farmer. He grew crops. And Abel was a what?
He was a shepherd.
That's right. So he had livestock. So Cain became jealous of Abel's sacrifices because the Lord favored a blood sacrifice over a burnt offering. And so Cain ended up killing. So there were these two. They actually considered them different professions, you know, taking care of livestock and ranching and then growing food. And so... I'm sorry for going down this path. It's easy to get in these conversations. So let's just move on. I just wanted to kind of highlight this point that, you know, some of these professions that we're dealing with today have literally had, I'll just say, a negative effect on society. from the Bar Association to the Hippocratic Oath and so forth, because what it has done is it has created these cliques or elitist societies. Where how does society benefit from that?
I don't know that it does.
Let's say we get to a point where, because if you look at how people progressed in the 1800s, it wasn't uncommon that a person could grow their own food, they could build their own house, they built their own furnishings. I mean, these people had understandings of you know, some basic engineering, you know, husbandry. I mean, they had a wealth of knowledge that they had. Just think now today, with all of the technology and everything else that we have access to, how much smarter and how much more self-sufficient we could be.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we allow ourselves to be categorized and thrown into where, you know, you have to have this, you know, to be a lawyer, to practice law, to represent yourself, you know, you really need to be a part of the Bar Association. And they create these barriers for purposes. It's almost like the officer and enlisted. The officer and enlisted was necessary at the beginning of the Union, but it wasn't necessary as education became so prevalent that, because that was the difference. The enlisted man was ignorant. He couldn't even write his own name, couldn't read. But today it's contrary. As a matter of fact, it's pointed out all the time that the people that have the knowledge of the avionics and mechanics and everything else to make that plane fly are enlisted. The guys that actually get behind and crash the thing and break it are officers, and they're more educated.
Supposedly. In fact, it's one of the things you'll hear from the Air Force is it's the only branch of service in which the enlisted men send the officers out to fight.
Yeah, I do know that, but I think the really prevailing thought is that when we look at the sophistry of what a person has to do in, you know, doing the maintenance, because I've known plenty of doctors. I know plenty of people that have, you know, these college degrees. They can't even work on their car. That mean they may be really smart in one little facet, but they're stupid about everything else because they've been so myopically focused. The point is that I think that that's an arcane way of operating because, you know, the justification of the officer and enlisted corps is gone, as far as I'm concerned. When we went to a voluntary service and people that, you know, educational standards, that's fine if you have educational standards for a particular career. But what's the difference between, you know, what that officer, his education, what does he bring to the table when it comes to, you know, leading, you know, riflemen? And so there's, I wrote a thesis on this. I don't want to go down this path, but bottom line.
I might be interested in that thesis sometimes.
Bottom line. There is no real justification. Corporations don't even do this. If you have a college degree or not, it doesn't mean that you're getting into their executive level. You have to earn your way through the, you know, through the ranks or whatever. And that's all politics. And politics exists on both sides of the enlisted and the officer ranks. And so, but in the officer ranks, it is steeped. It reeks of politics, where the enlisted is not so much. And I think that by melting this down to a single rank structure and just dividing it by technical or administrative actually makes more sense, because now you're either doing work with your hands or you're doing the administrative stuff. You know, there are different administrative roles, but nevertheless, we got 4 minutes. So go ahead and let's get to the next one that we're going to do here.
Dr. Taylor, compliant. I didn't read this already, right?
Oh, right.
Okay. Said the consideration of the eighth section had taken up a great deal of time. That gentleman had repeated the same arguments over and over again. And although the order of the convention was that the proposed constitution should be considered by paragraphs, he was pleased, he said, to observe that the honorable gentleman, fast speaking, had gone into the matter at large, and therefore he had hoped that other gentlemen would take the same liberty, and that all further observations may be on the system at large. So eighth section, I think they're talking about Article 1, Section 8.
Yes, correct. Yep. It's the only one with the eighth section. Yeah. And so he was complaining that there were people that were bloviating and diving into rat holes like we're doing. So if this guy was here today, he'd complain and go, hey, you're supposed to be reading this, you know, not going down all these rat holes. Anyway. Perfect timing, huh? Okay, so okay. The next one was Mr. Parsons, and this is all about the oath and religious tests. And this is interesting because, again, this is Massachusetts. Go ahead. Oh, by the way, we have 3.5 minutes, and I think you've got enough time to do the first paragraph easily.
All right, here we go. Oath and religious test. It has been objected that the Constitution provides no religious test by oath, and we may have in power unprincipled men, atheists, and pagans. No man can wish more ardently than I do that all our public offices may be filled by men who fear God and hate wickedness. But it must remain with the electors to give the government this security. An oath will not do it. Will an unprincipled man be entangled by an oath? Will an atheist or a pagan dread the vengeance of the Christian's God, a being, in his opinion, the creature of fancy and credulity? It is a solecism in expression. No man is so illiberal as to wish the confining places of honor and profit to any one sect of Christians. But what security is it to government that every public officer shall swear that he is a Christian? For what will then be called Christianity? One man will declare that the Christian religion is only an illumination of natural religion and that he is a Christian. Another Christian will assert that all men must be happy hereafter in spite of themselves. A third Christian reverses the image and declares that let a man do all he can, he will certainly be punished in another world. And a fourth will tell us that if a man uses any force for the common defense, he violates every principle of Christianity. Sir, the only evidence we can have of the sincerity of a man's religion is a good life, and I trust that such evidence will be required of every candidate by every elector. That man who acts in honest part to his neighbor will most probably conduct honorably towards the public.
Okay.
I don't know.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I was going to say, I don't know that I'll get this next paragraph.
No, we won't. We've got 1.5 minutes. It's barely enough time.
This is interesting. So what is he saying, it sounds like he's saying, what good is the oath? And I think.
A religious test.
Oh, okay.
So we've got the oath and then we have the religious. They're all in the same line. That right. All men may take it, but no religious test shall be measured on anybody seeking public trust or a public position or office. Well, anyway, so what there's talk about is we want to have people take an oath that they're going to support this Constitution. So we should at least be able to judge them. This is why this whole petition campaign, this whole petition plan, if we start petitioning now and pointing out how Holly, every single one of these, from the federal positions to the state to the county positions, and we start barraging them, we'll start ferreting through that the county supervisors or commissioners who are failing to actually hold people accountable are equally culpable and equally corrupt as the federal people that are violating their oath as well. We got to get rid of all of them. This is why the petition campaign is so important. And so we got 5 seconds. Go ahead.
All right. Well, thanks, Jared. I'd like to revisit this paragraph when we get back together because I've got more questions. But anyway, thanks.
No problem. And actually, we will get back. When we start on Tuesday, we'll dive into this and we'll actually go down the necessary rat holes. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.